the conversation about other media types, I think, is something I've been having a lot recently with clients, with guests on the podcast, and any SEO conversation I have at the moment. That is another element of that. If you have a question, you should have the answer to it. Also, do that as a video, do that as a podcast, and have different options for people to interact with your content. And if you're looking to drive people towards a newsletter, maybe somebody who's asking what is SEO wants to actually learn a little bit more, and they want an easy way to digest it every single week. And ta-da, there's your podcast conversion, right? I think you're totally right. You've got the kind of instincts there of like, well, if they are asking a question, then there might actually be a little, maybe not a direct purchase, but a chance to bring them into the fold. And maybe, you know, 6 months down the line, I think, yeah, that is my favorite newsletter, or, you know, my favorite podcast. Now I listen to the podcast every single week. It's appointment listening. I have to tune in every single time. And I don't know about you guys, but, you know, thinking about conversions from the podcast, there's extra opportunities for conversion there, right? You're nudging them in the right direction. Same with the newsletter. Even if they're not directly converting off that initial query, it's the whole attribution model of like, eventually, if you keep appearing in their searches, keep appearing in their feeds, they're going to recognize you, and there's a higher chance of conversion there.
Hi, and welcome to the Optimize Podcast. My name is Nate Matherson, and I am your host. On this weekly podcast, we sit down with some of the smartest minds in content marketing and SEO. Our goal is to give you perspective and insights on what's moving the needle in organic search. Today, I'm thrilled to sit down with Jack Chambers Ward, the host of the Search with Candor podcast and the marketing and partnerships manager at Candor, a full-service digital agency. Today's episode is a hot one. I've got some SEO hot takes for Jack, and I'm curious to hear his thoughts. We will also chat about scaling podcast marketing, newsletters, and a lot more. And this week's episode is brought to you by a newly launched company. That would be Positional. Positional just launched on March 26th. You might have seen it. I hope you did. And if you're one of the users who signed up, thank you so much for giving us a shot. We've been working on Positional for the last year. We've built a lot. We've got tools for keyword research, internal linking, content analytics, journey analysis, social media, and so much more. I've really tried to build the tool set that I've wanted as a content marketer over the last 10 years of building large content and SEO channels. We'd love for you to check it out at positional.com. Jack, thank you so much for coming on the Optimized Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Nate. I feel it's nice to reunite with you, right? Because you were on the Search with Candor podcast a few weeks ago. So it's nice to have it from the other side and kind of turn the tables a little bit, right?
Yeah, well, thank you again for having me on. That was so much fun. And you did such a great job in asking me questions. And so now it's my turn to ask some questions. And I'm feeling a little pressure knowing how good your episode was.
I'm so used to being the host. It's weird to be the other way around and be a guest once. So I'm feeling the pressure from the other side as well.
Well, we're going to start this episode off pretty fast. But before I get into the hot takes, I do want to ask you, how did you get into the world of content marketing and SEO? This is the first question I always ask our guests.
I think it's a similar story to a lot of people that I did it accidentally. And I was kind of doing another job. I was working at an international language school in-house, doing a bit of marketing and kind of more traditional marketing kind of stuff. And a few years into that role, I'd become marketing manager and kind of worked my way up the ladder a little bit. And I was still doing absolutely everything from fixing servers to, you know, helping our students apply for their visas and everything like that, but also doing the marketing stuff on the side and helping produce a lot of like printed materials and stuff like that. So it was pretty old school, to say the least. And then my boss was like, hey, we need a new website. And me and a kind of digitally minded colleague of mine were like, I mean, we could do that. We'll give it a go. We'll try it. And we built our first website for the company at the time. I was like, cool. Yeah, we'll update your terrible old WordPress build to something that is actually quite nice. And yeah, from there, we kind of learned what SEO was, learned what very, very basic, I don't claim to be a developer, very, very basic WordPress design was like. And yeah, kind of been doing digital marketing ever since. I then, after a couple of years, was let go from that role during the pandemic. You know, obviously international schools not being able to bring in international students because of COVID and stuff. So I was kind of stuck with, well, what do I do now? I was like, well, I really like this digital marketing thing, so I'm going to try that full time. So I ended up working for a couple of agencies, and I have now landed at Candor, coming up on 3 years now, which is pretty interesting, pretty cool. And yeah, really enjoying my now kind of hybrid role of a bit of SEO, but also a lot of the internal marketing stuff and events, podcasts, newsletters, and all that kind of stuff we do here at Gander as well.
Yes, no one grows up hoping that they're going to be an SEO or a digital marketer.
Is there a generation of people that have that as like their, you know, you get that careers advice meeting in high school or whatever, and they're like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, I want to be an astronaut. I want to be an SEO. Like, is that a thing?
I want to manipulate search results when I grow up. Going off script already, like you do see like on Twitter and LinkedIn, like people tend to, I don't know, maybe lately glamorize like being an SEO in some sense. Like you can make so much money online. Like you can make a lot of money online with SEO, but it's not that glamorous of a job. It just takes a lot of hard work over long periods of time, and eventually it works. Would you say that like SEO maybe as a strategy is the most popular it's ever been, or is SEO dead?
It's definitely not dead, not yet. I'm sure we'll touch on that later on in the show as well, because that's going to be a hot topic. But yeah, I think it is something that is becoming more and more popular. More and more people are aware of just the phrase SEO. Obviously, it's been around for 25 years at this point, even pre-Google stuff. I've had guests on the show and people I've worked with before who were working on like Yahoo and Jeeves and stuff, and all the pre-Google search engines that I remember from my childhood growing up in the 90s. But I think SEO is definitely becoming more and more popular. It's becoming a more viable career path and a more kind of well understood growth. As much as I joked about people, and you were saying there, like, I want to manipulate the search results for when I grow up, like, I think that might be a genuine thing. People seeing how much content marketing is shifting and how much SEO is kind of growing and changing, and all the other AI stuff we've got coming up on the horizon, I think there's a lot of opportunity there for more people to get into it. So yeah, I think it is going to get more and more popular. I don't know if we peaked just yet, but I think we're getting pretty close. I think it is. Maybe it's just because I'm in my little echo chamber of SEOs on social media, but it feels more popular to me than ever before.
Well, I do want to ask you about the changing search landscape and AI. Those are two of the hot takes that I've outlined, and we will get there. And, you know, at the end of the podcast episode that you and I did together on the Search with Candor podcast, you and I jokingly said, you know, we should talk about some SEO hot takes, because there are a lot of hot takes, especially lately. And so I want to talk through some of them with you and get your thoughts. And the first one is, what is the biggest mistake that you see SEOs making right now?
Oh, we're kicking off with a hot one here, Nate. That is a hot topic. And I think a lot of people are kind of thinking about a lot of the black hat, white hat kind of stuff. I know you had Charles Float on the podcast a few weeks ago talking about the difference between black hat and white hat and that whole like controversy there. For me, I think it's something really simple, something like internal linking and underestimating the power of internal linking. I know you and I touched on it on the episode of Search for Gander we did, Nate, like the power of internal links and how much you can actually shine a light on a page or a landing page or a product page or whatever it is, linking from your content to your product pages if you're working in e-commerce as well. Like there's so much potential there for helping not only users to navigate your site, but Google to understand the importance of your pages. I think internal linking is something that people are just like completely missing out on a lot of the time. And it's probably very common sense to people like us who work in SEO and stuff like that. But I think a lot of like people coming in really, really underestimate the power of it and are just like, oh yeah, I'll just have a really flat site structure and not worry about it too much. And I think I've seen so many super flat, and then also to the contrary, super, super deep, where you have to go through 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 different clicks to get to any juicy pages. Or if you land on a site from a piece of content, from a blog post, from a whatever, you then can't get back up to the category pages and find and navigate the rest of the site. Having something that actually links everything together, building those essentially those content clusters and those topic clusters, I think is something we all seem to be kind of aware of. Every time I go to a conference, every time I do a podcast, we all kind of talk about it, right? But I think a lot of people, not that many people are actually implementing it that well. And I think a lot of people are just seeing that phrase of like, ah, yeah, topic cluster, and just not actually doing it properly, in my opinion.
So I have a follow-up to this. And so I talk with a lot of SEOs each week in my job. And you know, I agree with you. I'm a huge fan of internal links and the importance of them. And I think they can make such a big impact. But I've noticed that like SEOs tend to fall into two different camps. You've got like your like hardcore silo people that like only want to be internally linking like in a tight group within a silo. And like they don't want to internally link from, let's say, silo to silo, even if they're loosely related to one another. And then you've got your SEOs who are, you know, they just want to link internally wherever they can if it's helpful for the reader. What is best? Should we be like rigid silo people here in 2024, or should we just be internally linking wherever it's helpful for the reader?
I think the internally linking wherever it's helpful the reader is the answer there for sure. Because like I said, I kind of mentioned it offhandedly there, right? It's not just a user navigation thing, but that is a huge part of it. And at the end of the day, and again, I know this is something you and I agreed on the Search the Candor podcast, Nate, like we want to do what's best for our users. As much as you can manipulate the search results and do parasite SEO or whatever it is, like all the technical wizardry that can get you in the SERPs, people actually engaging with your content. And that was essentially the topic of our episode, right? Was making our content better and more helpful for users. I think that's really helpful. I found it frustrating. I was literally working with a client who did a site migration last week. It was stressful, to say the least. And it was a whole process of having a conversation with them like, okay, if I land on your product page, how do I get back to your category page from here? And they just stared at me blankly. And I was like, okay, that is a problem. As a user, if I want to find a type of hoodie or a t-shirt or whatever, and I want to find out other similar products without either a related product things at the bottom or a way to go to that parent category through a breadcrumb or something, how do I get there? And they were like, use the main menu. I'm like, so everybody is just going to use the main navigation the whole time, all the time, and there's no internal links on pages. And they just kind of stared at me blankly. Like, yeah, that's frustrating as a user, let alone as SEO and building internal link stuff. Just from a navigation perspective, I found it frustrating going in kind of cold, like, because I was just helping this client out with the migration. It was a process for me to be like, I literally don't know how to get back to this page once I've clicked through. If I come from a category page without going back on my browser, which again, some people do, some people don't, it was pretty frustrating. So yeah, totally on the side of if you can internal link to it and it makes sense, I think you should do it.
What is one SEO best practice that is just a total waste of time?
Ooh, I love that you included best practice in there, because usually my answer to this would be like disavowing links and stuff, but I think that's kind of not in the best practice for most people these days. Most people are kind of not just randomly disavowing links and stuff, but I think best practices in general are fairly safe, and I think this is going to be a kind of ongoing topic throughout these hot takes. A lot of the SEO best practice stuff is fairly safe, but I think there's a clear kind of waste of time when people spend hours and hours and hours and hours going through and clearing up every possible like image size and really focusing on all the core web vital stuff. For me, when you get to a certain level of page speed where you can't really tell the difference as a user, and maybe you're in that like 70, you're looking on Lighthouse, you're looking on Page Speed Optimizer or whatever it is, and you're saying like, oh, we're like 75%, oh, we're like 80%, whatever, if it's fast enough, then you don't need to worry about that. I feel like that last little bit always takes so long, and you can end up minifying your JavaScript and going through this whole process, tidying up your CSS, and it could be such a hassle that actually the time put in is not worth the actual, you know, results you get out, the difference you get out.
I agree with you. A little part of me dies every time I talk to a startup that's like working with an SEO agency to do some like minor optimization on a core web vital. Like if the site loads reasonably fast, it's probably okay. As far as like EEAT goes, like, you know, you've heard about Google's guidelines here, expertise, experience, authoritativeness, trustworthiness. I'm going to give you three options. EEAT is a direct ranking factor. EEAT is an indirect ranking factor, or EEAT just does not matter whatsoever. It's total BS. What is it?
I'd go for option two, I think, because I think we're fairly well established now in that it's not a direct ranking factor. And I know the various Googlers who have been on Twitter and LinkedIn and whatever have been hammering this home over the last couple of months. Seem like all throughout 2024 so far, they have just been going, it's not a ranking factor. It's not a ranking factor. I think because they have such a strict definition of ranking factor, that's not the right way of discussing what EEAT is, right? It's an entire system that helps them understand the trustworthiness of your site. And that isn't directly affecting like, oh, we've now improved one of the E's, so we'll shoot up in the rankings. It's not as simple as that. I think it's a far more kind of complex web of how they actually understand the authoritativeness, the trustworthiness, firsthand experience, and everything coming together to then kind of, I think they say that everything, the EEA builds to the T, right? That trustworthiness is the final result of the other three kind of building together. So yeah, definitely in the middle of that. I think it is still important to think about and to worry about, but I don't think it's a direct ranking factor, and I don't think it's total BS.
Yeah, whenever Google says something's not a direct ranking factor, we should probably be paying attention to it. But yeah, I was at like the Brighton SEO conference towards the end of 2023, and Danny Sullivan was there, and he was talking about like authors and author bios. Should we have them on our pages or not? Does it matter? And he said that like adding an author bio to your page is not going to move the needle on that page, but it might be a factor that Google's algorithms would correlate off of to try to understand if your website has the characteristics of what would be a high quality or trusted one, which could in theory impact search rankings. And so I agree with you. I think it's an indirect ranking factor, but at the end of the day, I just think it's helpful for people coming to your website if you're making a point of doing it.
We're coming back to that result again, Nate. Exactly the same thing. Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, it's helpful to users. Like, then you should probably do it. Like, at the end of the day, ta-da, like, that's the answer to everything. And like, from a very white hat SEO perspective, I think that is the clue. And I know you're wearing your white hat today, Nate, so you're in full white hat mode.
We need to get some black positional hats at some. No, I'm just kidding. We did have Charles on the podcast very recently, and it was nice chatting about like gray hat, black hat, as he described money hat SEO. But on this podcast, we're mostly white hat. I do want to ask you about what is content. We've had guests on this podcast who hate what is content. They say, Nate, you're never going to convert a customer off of an article about what is SEO. And then we talk to other guests and they're like, Nate, you need what is content. It's important for topical authority. Also, you never know, like I've closed a six-figure deal from a piece of what is content. So you need it. So I want to ask you, is what is content just a total waste of time, or should we have what is content and then actually invest in what is content on our website? And as in what is, I mean, like, what is project management, for example?
Yeah. It, like when you look at the answer the public stuff and they add the prefix, right, of the what is, how does, how can, all that kind of stuff. I think what is usually very, very, if you think about the traditional marketing funnel, and I know we're kind of past that, but to simplify everything down, like that's kind of top of funnel stuff, right? That is initial research stage of like, what is this product? What is this service? They might have not even be looking to purchase at this stage. And I think there is a huge conversation to be had. I know this is something my friend Miriam Jessier, she mentioned during her SEO in 2024 section with Majestic, that was like the middle of the funnel, where that is where a lot of the juice is and where a lot of people are kind of underestimating. We either go super, super long tail, again, something I know you and I are very keen on, Nate, or you go super, super top level and you talk about the what is, how do, kind of like really, really broad subject questions. I think it's still valid, but I think you're right that what some of your guests have said over the past few months is like, it's less likely to convert because you are at that early stage. Chances are you're going to get more direct interaction and more, you know, chance of conversion from a very specific long tail kind of keyword based content rather than a broader, you know, what is kind of based thing. I also have the mentality that if your users and your customers or whoever it is that is coming to your website have questions, you should have an answer for it regardless. It's not just all about converting. And I think a lot of people kind of get stuck in that. They kind of, I know I keep referring back to our previous conversation, Nate, but it's still relevant. You mentioned falling in love with long tail, right? Because you get those conversions, you get that instant traffic, you get those really nice results straight away, and you don't have to wait 6-9 months and have a big battle with your competitors and all this kind of stuff. But I think there is validity in both sides. Depending on your niche, depending on what your audience is like, there are plenty of research tools out there that give you those kind of questions.
I love that. Like, I always like to think of my website as the search engine on a given topic. We want to fully answer that full spectrum of questions that someone might have in that buying journey. But speaking of conversion, and I know you mentioned conversion, I would think that for a user that's landing on like a what is SEO page, like they're probably not going to want to book a demo or get started with a free trial, but they might be interested in listening to your podcast, or they might be interested in signing up for your newsletter. And so have you seen that maybe for like higher in the funnel keywords, like you need to pitch or convert on something that is also higher in the funnel? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, definitely. I think the conversation about other media types, I think, is something I've been having a lot recently with clients, with guests on the podcast, and any SEO conversation I have at the moment. That is another element of that. If you have a question, you should have the answer to it. Also, do that as a video, do that as a podcast, and have different options for people to interact with your content. And if you're looking to drive people towards a newsletter, maybe somebody who's asking what is SEO wants to actually learn a little bit more, and they want an easy way to digest it every single week, and ta-da, there's your podcast conversion, right? I think you're totally right. You've got the kind of instincts there of like, well, if they are asking a question, then there might actually be a little, maybe not a direct purchase, but a chance to bring them into the fold. And maybe, you know, 6 months down the line, I think, yeah, that is my favorite newsletter, or, you know, my favorite podcast. Now I listen to the podcast every single week. It's appointment listening. I have to tune in every single time. And I don't know about you guys, but, you know, thinking about conversions from the podcast, you mentioned at the top of the show, like, oh yeah, I'm from Canada, we're from Positional, all this kind of stuff. There's extra opportunities for conversion there, right? You're nudging them in the right direction. Same with the newsletter. When we do our core updates newsletter here at Canada, we're linking to our sponsors, we're linking to our website, we link to the podcast episode. So there are extra opportunities there, even if they're not directly converting off that initial query. It's the whole attribution model of like, eventually, if you keep appearing in their searches, keep appearing in their feeds, they're going to recognize you, and there's a higher chance of conversion there.
Yeah, we had Noah Kagan on the podcast a month or so ago. And up until that point, I was very hesitant to talk about positional.com on the podcast. But his piece of advice as we were recording was like, you should actively be mentioning your brand and your website in the podcast. It's okay. People aren't going to freak out. And so now I find myself saying positional.com a lot more. But I just want to warn our listeners, the hot takes are about to get hotter. We've moved into like the second half of the hot takes, so get ready. The next one is, can you recover from the helpful content update?
The most recent one that happened, haven't seen much recovery.
Yeah, it was back to back. You know, there was the big helpful content update right at the start of October, and then there was the core algorithm update in November. And so the end of 2023 was just a volatile year in search, and there hasn't been a whole lot of recovery, if we're being honest.
I agree. Yeah.
And we could rephrase this question, like, if you got nailed at the end of 2023, can you get the traffic back, or is it just totally lost?
I haven't seen a success story yet, personally. I know quite a lot of niche sites, and quite a lot of we're mentioning people who are like super structured in their silos and stuff. I think a lot of people that were super, super focused on a particular niche really got hammered by that update. We have a content site here at Canada that is all about Dungeons and Dragons, because we're a bunch of nerds here at Canada. And we were specifically, you know, building that up, and Mark and I were having conversations about how, oh, once we get to this level of traffic, then we can think about monetization. We are both legitimate fans and knowledgeable players. I have been a dungeon master for nearly a decade now. Like, I really know what I'm talking about. It's one of my absolute specialist subjects. And a bunch of our writers, we were working with freelance writers who we were paying and stuff, who were legit subject experts who really know what they're talking about, bringing in firsthand expertise and all that kind of stuff. And we got nailed by the helpful content update. The traffic just absolutely dropped off a cliff. And we'd seen a couple of wobbles and stuff, but we'd always managed to recover. But this has really been a big kind of transformative thing for us. It's like, okay, we did everything right. We even talked to people like Lily Ray, people like Marie Haynes, you know, these people who go through and do this amazing research and look into helpful content updates and recovery and all that kind of stuff. What could have possibly been hit by it? At the end of the day, and this might open up another can of worm of hot takes, we didn't have that many links. We were creating good content. We were creating, you know, we were putting our money where our mouth is, really, and saying like, this is legit good content. I had been searching, and a friend of mine had been searching independently, and our site had popped up, and he'd said it had been useful and stuff. I was like, it doesn't get better than this, right? That we're doing great work. It's all working. People are finding us organically. Turns out, not enough. And yeah, I think because we were so fresh and so new, we only started it in 2023, brand new, bought the domain, all that kind of stuff. So we had no like history of significant links coming through. I think we got hammered by it. And I think that's what has been true for a lot of the other sites. I have yet to see a genuine 100% or even like 80, 90% recovery from this recent helpful content update. And I think, to be fair, here's a hot take for you, Nate. I think a lot of those sites deserved it because they're a bunch of crap. But also, there were some good ones that got caught up in there as well. So,
yeah, I agree with you. There's good and bad. You know, one of our customers got negatively impacted in the helpful content update, and they asked me why. And I looked at their website. Their website's fantastic. Like, I think they do a great job. And so my advice to them was like, stay the course.
Yeah.
Like, I think you're putting in the work. Like, it can be incredibly frustrating, but like, from my view, it looks like you're creating great content. You're sourcing it. You've got independent research. Like, I think you're thinking about things the right way. It's just, it doesn't feel great when you are doing good work and you do get hammered. But speaking of backlinks.
Uh-oh. I opened the can of worms.
Yeah, this is a fun one. You hear many different takes from our guests on backlinks, but I'd be curious to ask you, in 2026, so we're looking 2 years out, not even 2024. I don't care about 2024, but 2026, are backlinks going to be like more or less important than they are today?
Google seems to say that they're less important, and they've been saying that a lot recently. If I'm just sticking in 2024 at first, I will transfer to 2026 in a moment. But there is that kind of like, really? Do I believe you? From what I literally just said about our content site that got hammered, we think it was because of the lack of links, because the content was there. I don't know if you experienced that with your customer as well, like in that example, but I've seen that from other examples as well, where it's all good content, you're doing the right thing, best practices, blah, 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 but the links are not there. And I think links are so fundamental to how Google understands the quality of your site, how you're being linked to from authoritative sources and all this kind of stuff. I really can't imagine them like totally disappearing, but I guess they probably will be less important if you want to kind of draw the line at less important in 2026. I think they will be, but I can't imagine any time, you know, in the next 6 months, 12 months, so coming up to 2025, that they will actually be like, oh yeah, backlinks don't matter anymore. Links from authoritative sites, digital PR and link building and all that kind of stuff doesn't matter anymore. Because again, coming back around to the conversation about users and customers and stuff, there's also an element of getting your face, essentially your brand out there and saying, oh wow, BBC or Forbes, whatever, link to positional. Can you believe it? They must know what they're talking about. You're building up that authority in your user's mind. So even if it's not directly related to ranking factors, and for the record, I still think it is, and I think it still will be in 2026, I think there's still a value there for growing your brand and growing your visibility as a whole as well, right?
You're about halfway into this week's episode of the Optimized Podcast, and I just want to let you know about our buyer journey product. It's a really cool one, and it just came out. It gives you insight into where users are traveling throughout your website. You can look at entry and exit flows. So for example, if you want to see all of the different pages that a user has traveled down by the time they've reached your Book a Demo page, you could do that. Or for example, if you want to see the pages that users go down or travel through after reaching your homepage, you can see that too. Positional's buyer journey product is meant to give you insights in terms of how users are engaging with your site and how they ultimately end up to their final destination. We'd love for you to check it out at positional.com. And now back to the rest of this week's episode. By the way, Reddit, I want to ask, because like just recently, you know, Google signed what is a $60 million deal with Reddit. And on Twitter, like you hear SEOs complaining, because that's what they're doing all of the time, about like Reddit taking up too much real estate in the search results. I said complaining.
On Twitter, I think that's fair.
But, you know, Glenn from a Viper Chill put together what is like an awesome report on like Reddit in the SERPs that we should all go check out. He did such a great job with that. Basically highlighting that like Reddit in the SERPs isn't always a good thing for searchers, and that there's a lot of spam that's getting included into the SERPs as a result of what seems like Reddit's higher profile in the SERPs broadly. But with this new deal that Google and Reddit have signed, I wonder, like, what do you make of this like new Reddit and Google partnership?
I think it's an interesting one, because I have definitely experienced the Reddit showing up in the SERPs thing recently. And I know you're totally right, Nate. A lot of people are complaining about it, and that's kind of what SEO Twitter is these days. But I think it's a pretty valid complaint sometimes. I have seen Reddit legitimately outranking the original source of information multiple times on multiple SERPs for completely different industries, completely unrelated searches. And I don't know like how the actual relationship, like Google now having access to the Reddit data API and saying they're essentially going to deliver that information in more real-time, unique, structured ways and all that kind of stuff. Again, as much as you said earlier, Nate, like we should listen when Google starts talking, I do think a lot of the time you need to take it with a big pinch of salt as well and understand like, yeah, we're improving the SERPs. I'm like, are you though? Because they're now kind of talking about trying to kind of roll back or work out how they can kind of get rid of, not really get rid, de-emphasize Reddit and Quora and all the forum stuff that's been absolutely taking over the SERPs for a lot of queries recently. But I do think there is a lot of money to be made here. And oh boy, do big companies like Google and Reddit like making a lot of money. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not convinced this is necessarily a positive thing. And the Reddit platform itself is absolutely in the toilet right now, in my opinion, and has been for a while and has been, you know, kind of ruined by a lot of mismanagement and stuff like that. So yeah, I've kind of lost faith in Reddit at this point, to be honest.
I am personally not a Redditor.
The time is not to start now.
Next one. This one's pretty controversial, and I can tell you what I think after. But publish dates, do they matter?
Sometimes.
Just to clarify that question, the date that's actually listed on the article or the page.
Literally having it on the page in text form.
Yes, yes.
Interesting. I think it doesn't matter necessarily from a ranking perspective, because the actual creation of the page is, you know, Google can tell that. They don't need you to literally spell it out for them. There is plenty of other ways for them to find that out. But for me as a user, seeing, oh wow, this was written 6 years ago, it's probably not relevant anymore, or this was written 2 weeks ago, or this was written today, oh my god, what a coincidence, wow, like how brilliant, that's the freshest, most up-to-date content. I think it can be valid, but it's not the be-all and end-all. I think coming back around to what we were talking with WEAT stuff, right? People so focus on, you got to have an author bio, that you got to have their name and then it links to them and make sure you mention when the thing was published and if it's been updated since and all that kind of stuff. I think it can be useful for a user perspective, but I don't think it's the be all end all of authorship stuff.
Google, I think, has said it's not a direct ranking factor.
They have, yes.
But like, I am of the opinion that if I am scrolling through the first page, and I'll give you an actionable example, like one of our customers in a highly technical industry that's changing all of the time is ranking on the first page with an article dated from 2012. And I said to them, like, if I was a searcher, I would be much more likely to want to click on something from 2024 than 2012.
100%. Yeah.
And so I have to think that it has a positive impact on click-through rate, which is a direct ranking factor.
Yes.
Which would then have a positive impact on search rankings. I think that is my perspective.
That is also the assumption that Google will display the published date on the SERP, right? They don't always necessarily include that. In general, they do, don't get me wrong. But yeah, I think you're totally right. That is building that faith in the user, right? Understanding, like we were saying earlier, with that trustworthiness of like, do I really want to learn about, like you said, if it's a super technical thing, chances are the industry has gone away. The amount of things that change in technology and even going way outside side of SEO, just in general life as a whole, 12 years ago we barely had smartphones, you know, like it was like second generation iPhones. Think of that now, and I now have my Samsung folding thing and like all kinds of crazy stuff. Like 12 years ago is a long time in technology, and if you're working in a space that is evolving, and I think pretty much every industry is shifting in most ways at the moment and will continue to. I agree with you. I think you would want to see something that is a little bit more up to date. I don't know. Do you have like a cutoff date in mind of like, I've had this conversation with clients before of like, it obviously depends on the industry, but if it's not been updated in the last like 18 months, 2 years is usually my go-to for like, maybe think about rewriting it. Or like, I know the obvious answer is just to take it and write updated 2024, 2024 edition or whatever. And that's not necessarily the best way of doing it, because I've also had clients do that and then not update the information. And then companies have gone out of business since they last updated it. Like, yeah, you're linking to the wrong thing here. You know that, right? That company doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, and I don't have an answer to this question, but I will ask it to the universe. Maybe you know, Jack. So one of our actual first podcast guests, Dave Rathmanner, he pinged me on Slack the other day and asked me what is a really great question. I hope, like, basically Dave's point was like, Google doesn't want you just updating your published dates for the sake of updating your published dates to try to game the SERPs in some way. And they've said that. And so his point was, do you think Google would care if you just flip the dates from 2023 to 2024 on a given page without actually making substantial content changes? Would they see that in the same light as maybe switching your published dates too often if you're switching the dates on your title tag, for example, too often? And you can get even more granular than just 2024. For example, in certain cases, you might have like March 2024, April 2024, May 2024. 2024? And I said to Dave, I don't know. Like, I don't know what Google would think of that. This might be something we're overthinking, but do you have any thoughts on that?
There's an element. I think the positive side of it is that you want to think about content freshness. And I know this is something a lot of people working in PR, again, something we touched on our episode of Search for Candidate, was like the having that most up-to-date data and all that kind of stuff is a positive. And you can kind of trick people into thinking that just by updating the title tag and, oh, you see on the SERP that it was updated in February 2024, March 2024, April 2024. It's like, wow, it must be valid. But I've seen that work for the record from competitors and from my clients as well. But I've also seen it, like I said, if you're not updating and you're not at least reading through it again, like actual legit, not just skim reading it, read it out almost out loud in your head and make sure that it actually makes sense without realizing, like I said, companies going out of business, broken links, all that kind of stuff. I've seen it backfire. So I think if the content is good and if it is somewhat evergreen, I think it can work. And I don't think Google necessarily will penalize you for updating too often, because I think there is a valid use case for that, right? If you are keeping up to date with one of my clients is very, very seasonal, for example. They work around sort of like Valentine's and Easter and Mother's Day and all this kind of stuff. And they have best practice from my side for like seasonal pages to keep a date neutral URL. So just have like domain.com/Mother's Day or domain.com/Valentine's Day or whatever it is. And then update that each year with the latest thing. And I found a really useful thing is archiving those old versions and linking off to them at the bottom. So like, here's our previous year's stuff. So for Valentine's Day in 2024, here's what you should be buying for your partner or whatever. If you're interested in our 2023 list, here's an old URL. That is actually the newer URL, but it is specifically mentioned that it's from 2023. And I found that really, really works. That's kind of been my golden rule for a lot of, especially my e-commerce clients, my seasonal clients. That has worked really well, having this kind of hub page that is updated regularly and then archiving the older stuff below it.
Speaking of seasonality in SEO, have you seen that leading into a season, let's say like the week before Valentine's Day, you see an increasing amount of volatility in the SERPs leading into that season?
100%. Yeah, I have another old client of mine. They basically did like 60 to 70% of their business in Christmas time. They specialized in Christmas jumpers of different kinds of Christmas sweaters to the US listeners. And that was a whole conversation as well, to briefly tangent. It was like, what do we put in our page sales? Should we put sweaters or jumpers? I'm like, where's the market? Like, do you need to have a separate US and UK conversation here? And that was the whole thing. And it can happen a lot earlier than you think. Like, for example, they start marketing their stuff end of August, beginning of September. I don't know. Most listeners and viewers are probably rolling their eyes of like, oh, I don't want to deal with Christmas stuff in September. I'm one of those people. I don't want to talk about Christmas. I don't think about Christmas until the 1st of December. But plenty of people do. And if you want to make money off those people, you kind of need to worry about it. So yeah, I have seen really, really volatile SERPs. I've seen competitors almost appear and disappear overnight in SERPs, pretty much, when it comes to, especially, I think Valentine's Day is a really good example there, Nate, because that is such a short period of time. And as a man myself, I think we're all kind of guilty at doing super late minute, oh God, I've got to run to the shop and get a bunch of flowers and fingers crossed she's not going to kill me kind of thing. There's a lot of late night stuff going on of like free next day delivery kind of stuff of like, you can get flowers delivered to your partner or Mother's Day to your mum or whatever it is. I think there is a lot of valid kind of stuff in there for the SERPs being updated, but I have seen a lot of volatility for sure.
Yes, on Valentine's Day, I picked up the gifts on my way home from the office.
Living the stereotype though, mate. I appreciate that. We've all done it.
Yes. And I have just one more hot take, because I do want to ask you about podcasts and newsletters. I think there's a lot we could talk about there. Last hot take, and we may have beaten this one to death on the podcast, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts. AI generated content. Are you using it? Should you be using it right now in 2024?
It's interesting, because we had a Search Norwich event in February where we had two talks completely independently talking about using AI in your process and in your content creation process. I think there are a lot of ways you can use AI to bounce ideas off of or come up with different suggestions and all that kind of stuff. I personally don't use it to literally write my actual content that ends up on the page. I use it as like, oh, come up with 5 ideas. For example, I do another podcast all about movies, and I use it to come up with titles for the movies that I'm writing. recently, again, but back in February, we did an episode on the sequel to Donnie Darko. I don't know if you remember that film from 2001. There is a sequel to that that is terrible, and I had to write a sequel to that for my podcast. I was like, what the hell do I call this thing? Like, do I include the name? How do I come up with this? And I was like, I use Bard, I use ChatGPT. I was kind of like, hey, come up with 5 different examples of potential names for a sequel to Donnie Darko that's released in 2016, directed by the director David Robert Mitchell. This tone, this setting, I said it in Georgetown University in Washington. Like, I was coming up with all these different specific things, and they were awful. They were really, really bad examples, but it kind of pointed me in a direction. I kind of use it. My process is bouncing ideas off each other. And that's something I learned from BB the Link Builder, somebody I hugely respect. I think she's amazing in all of her digital PR and link building stuff. She said, use it as essentially like a writing partner. If you were sat there co-working with somebody, or whatever, like, what do you think of this thing? Like, do you think this title works? Do you think this paragraph makes sense? All that kind of stuff I think is valid, but I never use it to, hey, Bard, hey, GPT, write this thing, write a paragraph on this thing, if that makes sense.
That makes sense to me. Donnie Darko. I have never seen this movie, but Jake Gyllenhaal is in it.
Early Jake Gyllenhaal and Maggie Gyllenhaal as well. They literally play brother and sister, and they're brother and sister in real life.
Speaking of podcasts, really quick for our listeners, what's the name of your movie podcast?
It is called Sequelizers. I've actually got it written on my t-shirt here, conveniently enough. If you're watching on YouTube, you can go and check that out.
Oh, nice. Oh, so it's just about sequels.
It's just about bad movie sequels. So essentially what we do, we take bad movie sequels and we recast, rewrite, come up with a new director, and we basically write like a 2,000 word-ish version as if we were making the sequel ourselves. So Donnie Darko being the most recent one I wrote, was pulling my hair out. Like, Donnie Darko is good. S. Darko, which is based on his sister's name, is terrible. So how would we do it? How would we come up with it? And it's me, my co-host Matt, and my co-host Tim. We take it in turns, essentially going around and fixing bad movie sequels. And we have been going for nearly 8 years now, I think 7.5 years, something like that. Listeners, viewers, again, you mentioned, don't be afraid to plug your stuff in podcast episodes, Nate, so I'm going to do it. Go to sequelizers.com. That's SEQUELISERS if you want to come and check out movie stuff, if you're interested in stuff outside of SEO and want to check out movie things.
Yeah, we'll include a link in the show notes for all of our listeners.
Thank you.
So speaking of podcasts, and it feels like everybody's got a podcast these days.
Yes, it does.
Are there too many podcasts out there, or are podcasts still an opportunity?
I'm going to fence it a little bit and say both, but I think there are definitely too many podcasts out there. That is pretty, I feel like throughout the pandemic era, that is kind of unquestionable when everyone and their dog was starting a new podcast. Like, well, I'm stuck at home now, I guess I'll start a podcast. And everyone was just talking about any old thing. And to the credit of some people, like, some of my favorite podcasts started during that era and have carried on and stuff. But I know there was a statistic a few years ago that was like 90% of podcasts never make it past the first 5 episodes because people think, oh, it's easy. I'm just talking. I'm just going to talk with my friends or my partner, and ta-da, there's no production. There's no whatever. And I know podcast producer Zachary is nodding along in the background here because you understand the pain and editing and production and all the stuff that actually goes into a quality podcast like something like Optimize, where it's not just, hey, let's just chat for an hour and see what happens. We went through show notes. You and I have talked before, Nate. We went through that process. Same with Search for Candor. There's a lot of production that goes into this. I think there is definitely opportunity there. And I think a lot of people I speak to who are starting new podcasts, it's kind of similar to what a lot of people are saying in SEO, where you kind of have to find your niche, right? If you're starting a site that is going to be like, oh, I'm going to give financial advice. I'm like, okay, what differentiates you from the Financial Times or Forbes or all these other household names that are just going to absolutely trounce you? Like, how do you, oh, I want to specifically talk about this particular type of financial advice and really focus and hone down. There's a reason I don't just do a movie review podcast, because there's a million of those bloody things around. We focused in on bad movie sequels because there are a couple of other podcasts that do that. And somebody even tried to steal our name once and we had to send an angry email to them. But I think that you have to understand the niche and the opportunity. Is it appropriate for your, like, if you're a startup, if you're a client or whatever it is, if you're a company thinking about an internal podcast, is it relevant to you and your audience? Like, if you're, no offense to the construction industry, I can't imagine many construction people are suddenly going to be interested in a construction podcast. Again, I'm probably totally wrong. There's probably some construction industry podcast that is got a million listeners and is way more popular than anything I've ever done. But I think you need to understand your industry and your audience before you even start thinking about a podcast. And that's something I've definitely experienced over the last 12 years is I've hosted 7 podcasts and I started 5 of them. So yeah, I have experience in both good and bad, success and failure in many years of podcasting.
Speaking of success, what does success look like for a podcast, or how do you measure the success of a podcast?
That depends on your intent, I guess. Like for us here at Search with Candor, it's very much growing the brand, making connections. It's a big networking thing. So obviously working with you guys at Positional Understanding, I think the Search with Candor podcast listeners know you guys have sponsored the podcast in the past, and we were having that conversation. I was like, well, I've already listened to the Optimized podcast, so let's have Nate on as a guest. And having that conversation, I think there's totally valid networking opportunities and connections and things like that. For us, that's kind of our goal from the Search with Candor. It doesn't make that much money in the grand scheme of the company. Like obviously our main SEO and marketing tools and the actual work we do for our clients makes far more money than the actual podcast does. But I think there's still a lot of valid opportunities for even things like getting backlinks, have people linking back to podcast episodes. As long as you have a page on your site, exactly like you guys do for this show, where people can click, say, oh, I heard that episode when Jack was on Nate's podcast. Here's a link. And you can very kind of, I was going to say sneakily, but cleverly get backlinks from people just recommending the show to you. For on Sequelizers, we've monetized the show through a thing called Patreon. So we have some monthly subscribers who pay to get bonus content or pay to vote on the films that we fix, or literally some people literally pay enough money that they can tell us exactly, I want you to fix this film next month. And we kind of have to do what we're told because they're paying us money. So there is different elements there. And I think, and for your audience, thinking of startups and people working in marketing, I think you need to think about a niche or what kind of your intent is behind what you want from the podcast. Do you just want to grow your network or do you want to literally get listeners and eventually monetize this, put in ads, get sponsors, all that kind of stuff? I can also think you can also do both. We monetize Search with Candor through sponsorships, and we also, you know, grow the network and stuff like that. I've literally had people at conferences recognize my voice from the podcast and say, oh, you're that guy from the podcast, right? I went, hello, yeah. It's like, oh, wow. Didn't recognize my face, never met me before, but they recognized my voice at a conference. I sat next to, funny enough, a guest on the show, Gus Pologia, who I really, really like. He sat next to me in a restaurant, big group of SEOs just going out for lunch or whatever. Bunch of us didn't know each other, and he sat next to me. And I was chatting away to the other person next to me, and he turned and went, are you from that Candor podcast? And I recognized your voice from someone. I was like, yes, that's me. You can get that element of like recognition if you're going to grow your brand, like if you're going out to conferences and events and looking to get your face out there. I'm very lucky that Mark has kind of helped me become part of the face of Candor, as much as Mark is very, very much still the face of Candor and still our kind of driving force in terms of leads and stuff. I'm starting to build that relationship and kind of growing that. And that's partly why I'm now marketing and partnerships manager, right? That's part of growing those partnerships. So there's lots of different ways I think you can make it work. It doesn't have to come. I'm going to be totally transparent. We don't have millions of listeners at Search with Candor. Sequelizers, my other podcast, because it's such a broader topic, has like 10 times the listeners of Search with Candor. But Search with Candor, I think, has much more engaged listeners. It's a more niche thing. And I think you guys experience this from talking to you guys about Optimize as well. You know that the people are in the industry are going to be engaged, are going to be asking questions and all this kind of stuff, that community is much more focused for a SEO specific or a content marketing specific podcast.
Yeah, like an SEO, not all traffic or listeners are of the same value or quality.
100%.
And a lot of what you said resonates with me, given that we're 40 some odd episodes into this podcast. So last question before we jump to the lightning round. Newsletters, I know you've recently launched a new one.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that and why you launched it now?
Yeah. Like I said, I think it's a hugely oversaturated market. I said the same thing about podcasts. And I think what the intention Mark and I went in with Core Updates is really kind of filtering everything down to, I think Mark tends to cut off at about 8 specific stories from that week that are relevant to the subscribers and really, really kind of tune out all of the crap and all of the noise and all that stuff. Because I don't know if you've noticed, I don't know if you guys are active subscribers to a lot of newsletters. I am, to kind of keep an eye on a lot of the rest of the industry and stuff. And I will see whether it's agencies or consultants or freelancers or totally, you know, tool creators or whatever it is. There's a million different newsletters and they all, from my experience, get longer and longer, it seems, every few months. And like, oh yeah, we started off with one segment that just tells you the news, and then there's a segment, then there's a sponsor segment, and then there's another segment of more links, because then you can get more links going out. It's like, okay, great. And some newsletters I find now are like unbelievably long, and I'm just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling trying to find the important stuff. So the intent from Mark and I side was to condense all that stuff down and really, really give you the important highlights that actually matter. We also release it first thing on a Monday. So hopefully, especially for you guys in the US or a few hours ahead of us, by the time you get to work, you will have that in your inbox ready to go. So if you have a morning meeting and your boss says like, oh, what's been going on in marketing? What's going on in SEO recently? You have half a dozen stories, articles, links there to be like, oh, turns out Google just signed this agreement with Reddit. Turns out this isn't a ranking factor. Turns out this thing, I got this information from Core Updates. And that was kind of the intention there. Also want to highlight the podcast as well. I include the podcast every single week. So that's kind of an element there. Like I said, that kind of extra engagement, extra conversion side of things. But really the differentiating matter for us was like condensing everything down into a no BS, fewer than 10 stories. This is the important stuff you actually need to care about.
Yeah, well, we'll include a link to your new newsletter, Core Updates, in the show notes as well for all of our listeners to go check out. And Jack, if it's okay with you, I've just got three lightning round questions I'd like to ask. Does that sound good?
Let's do it. Let's go for it.
All right, cool. Question number one. You mentioned that you are a dungeon master. What does a dungeon master do?
Do you want the safe for work version or the not safe for work version? No, I'm joking.
I guess I want whatever version it would serve the search intent of that keyword.
That's a very, very SEO way of spinning on it there. I appreciate that. It is basically the person who runs, writes, organizes a Dungeons & Dragons game. So you are the person that is playing the bad guys and fighting against your team of companions. So typically you have like a handful of players who will be playing and one dungeon master who is running the game. And kind of think of it like the referee, but also the person who is playing the villain. And I think what a lot of people get stuck into is like, oh, I have to play the villain and I want to be the bad guy. But it's really more of a collaborative thing. You're collaboratively storytelling with your friends in that group. So you are kind of like the judge and jury and sometimes the executioner if the players are bad enough. But yeah, you're kind of running the Dungeons & Dragons game, essentially.
We've talked a lot about sequels on this podcast. What's the most underrated sequel that we should all go and watch this weekend?
That is a juicy, juicy question, Nate. And I could do a whole other podcast, funnily enough, about that. For me, I think something that has really gone underrated is the modern Planet of the Apes trilogy. I don't know if you've seen Dawn, Rise, and War of the Planet of the Apes that were like the, I think it was like 2011, 2014, 2018, something like that, wherever those.
Yeah, there's a new one coming out too, right?
There is, yeah, there's a new one coming out later this year. And the second and third ones, so Dawn and War, I always get them around the wrong way. I think that's the right way around. The second and third in that trilogy, for me, are some of the best films of like the last 10, 15 years. I absolutely think they're masterpieces. They're directed by Matt Reeves, who went on to do The Batman. So if you enjoyed The Batman and his kind of visual style and stuff, a lot of that comes through. The CGI is mind-blowingly good, even it being 10 years ago. They were doing motion capture like live on set, on stage with explosions and guns and chimps riding horses, and that sounds like I'm making that up. I promise they do actually ride horses. It's amazing, and you can't believe these apes aren't real sometimes, and it is all computer generated and absolutely stunning. And one of the best like final fight scenes in the second one, when Caesar stands up to the other kind of ape who is trying to usurp his place, is emotional, spectacular, and just absolutely brilliant.
We will include more links in the show notes.
I'm just giving you all the links to include in the show notes.
To all the SEOs who are worried about externally linking, we're not. And my last question is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
I'd just like to say thank you for supporting SEO podcasts, basically, because And I like I said, I'm a genuine listener of this show. I am a consumer of podcasts as I am a maker of podcasts. I really like what you guys are doing. There's a reason I wanted to come on the show and have a conversation with you guys in the first place. So listeners, go and check out other SEO podcasts as well. I think there's a lot of different options around. Obviously, hello, come and check out Search with Kanda. But I think what you guys have been doing on Optimizer has been really, really cool to see a different variety of guests and see a lot of different conversations. And I like that you guys aren't afraid to ask the weird and interesting questions, because I think there's a lot of safe kind of like, oh, I can't possibly ask that question. It'll upset the guests or upset the sponsor or whatever it is. And yeah, you guys don't do that. So listeners, well done for supporting a cool SEO podcast.
Well, thanks for coming on, Jack. And to all of our listeners, if you've made it this far, please leave us a kind review. If you've enjoyed this episode, someone did recently leave us a 1-star review, so we've got to make up for that. So you can leave us a review if you've enjoyed this one, or if you haven't, that's fine too. But Jack, thank you so much for coming on the Optimized Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I genuinely really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Optimized Podcast. As you may have seen, yesterday was our public launch day. It was a fun day. I didn't get much sleep, but I'm excited to welcome a new cohort of users to our platform. If you're interested in signing up for Positional, head on over to positional.com. I think you're really going to get a kick out of what we've built. We've got tools for keyword research, tools for internal linking, tools for content analytics, and a heck of a lot more. We'd love for you to join our public launch week at positional.com. We'll be right back.